I grew up here. My stepdad had gotten a job with Washington State. But yeah, we moved over and I was like six, so I claim Washington. That's where I grew up. You know, this is where my roots are at, really. I went in October of 2000 and went to Fort Benning for basic training. I joined as a medic. After basic training, they sent me to Fort Sam Houston, Texas. Then I ended up getting stationed at Fort Hood, Texas after finishing AIT. I got to Fort Hood and got stationed with division support battalions, so there's a large number of medics. Basically, our responsibilities were the division aid station, as well as our battalion aid station, and then the motor pool stuff that we had to do, covering ranges for everybody in the division. And so I actually spent most of my time, my first 2 years in Texas, down in the motor pool, because in the division support, there were men and women together, as opposed to like a combat arms unit where there's no women. When I graduated AIT, I was an honor grad. I was a good medic and was really looking forward to getting to my unit and getting to start doing the medical stuff. As soon as I got there, I started seeing a little bit how the military works with being able to be taken advantage of as well. And how it seemed like at that time anyways, a lot of the women that I was serving with, they seemed to be the ones that were always on some kind of light duty or something so that they didn't have to work down in the motor pool, and they would man the aid stations, and then the guys that were in the battalion would have to be down in the motor pool. So it was kind of a weird first couple of years for me, just because I didn't feel like I was really filling my job. After a little over 2 years in Texas, I knew that I was going to be getting orders to go somewhere overseas. I called up Branch and I said, you know, I know I'm going to be getting orders soon, so what are my chances of choosing where I go? Based on my MOS, I had a few different choices. So I chose Germany. And my big reason, I guess, with Germany was just because it was a two-year duty station, so I knew that I would finish out the rest of my first term there, and I wouldn't have to move again. I wasn't sure at that time if I wanted to continue or not after, you know, my first contract was up. Technically, I went early, mid-January of 2003. So I got over to Germany and I got stationed with a combat arms unit. So we were a tank battalion, and it was the first time up to that point in my military career where I was really getting to do my medical job every day. I mean, it was short-lived because I got deployed right after that, but I was able to brush up enough on my skills before getting deployed. I was with a scout platoon. We were part of 1st Infantry Division, but we went to Iraq to support the 173rd Airborne. Then we were indirectly umbrellaed underneath 4th ID, which was kind of funny because that was the same division that I had served with in Fort Hood, Texas. When we first got into Iraq, we air inserted, and it was a clay runway, like just an empty large space. But what had happened was the 173rd had jumped in 2 days prior because we ended up not being able to land the first night we were flying in. And they turned us back around because the conditions weren't good enough. So we came back the next day, and that was when we finally set foot in Iraq. And then we took a couple of days to set up home. And Kirkuk was, I believe it was an Air Force base. We actually shared Kirkuk with half Army, half Air Force. We were living the first 3 months on the tarmac where our vehicles were parked and stuff. We just had tents set up and were sleeping on cots, and that was life for the first 3 months. We basically were just tasked with places that the intel guys were telling us were insurgent activity going on or resistance activity. That being said, the information that we had for those hotspots was as loose as one of the townspeople coming up and telling our interpreter, we have one of Saddam's soldiers living in our house, which we then later found out because we didn't get much of a history of the region or anything before we went over there. It was just, they gave us like this little Iraq handbook for us to flip through, but we didn't realize that they had all their land taken from them, you know, 30 years earlier when Saddam got into power. And so that group ended up basically just pillaging and kicking the Kurdish people out onto the street. A lot of the time what we'd end up doing is we would take this information, we would go kick in a door and raid, you know, a house. And that Iraqi soldier would be like a 60 or 70-year-old guy who 30 years earlier had done this, but these people were trying to now exact their revenge. So that kept us real busy the first months. I mean, outside of that, there were incidences definitely where we found, you know, weapons caches and large sums of money, although I'll say, these were families who, I mean, once the occupation started, banks shut down. There was no way for them to access what they might have had in there anymore. And so a lot of families took what they had, took what they could get. We had to guard this bank in the middle of town because there was no money left in it anymore or anything, but it was the idea that it was going to be up and running again. What we eventually did was brought in US money. The dinar was worth nothing anymore. So we would do stuff like that. Our battalion S1 kept track of the number of raids that we did. And I think my platoon had 320 or something like that. Had the intelligence been a lot better at that time, and also had the foresight to think that if this is going to be going on for the next 10 to 15 years, maybe we don't want to be terrifying these little kids that in another 10 years from now are going to be a fighting age. You're making a whole generation of people take a lot of honor in trying to get rid of the people that they've seen taking over their country. There was a lot of people that welcomed us, but for my group of 34, 35 guys, there's 300 plus that we traumatized. You put that together with how many people that have been over there in total, and it's not hard to understand where they're coming from. As long as we went out of the gates and we all came back alive, it was a successful day for us. But at the same time, it became really, really difficult for me because I realized if somebody were to come and occupy the states the way that we had done, I would expect every able-bodied person to stand up and try and resist that. In my eyes, that's all that those people were doing, is they were just trying to protect what was theirs. And I think, they were happy with us initially getting Saddam out of power. Once that had all been done, it was kind of like, okay, what are we still over here for then? With the scout platoon, we shifted our mission and we started having to do security missions, bringing the oil guys out. And here we are, the ones that are guarding them and expected to take a bullet for them. And we're making, I mean, I was an E4 at the time. I was making 32, 33,000 a year. Add combat pay, and it was maybe like another 10 or 12 grand, but definitely not in balance with, the people we were there to protect. Not even in the ballpark. That was maybe like the first little indicator to me that the prospect that this wasn't going to end anytime soon, and started to question a little bit our motives for being over there. We had a pretty large firefight in May of 03. It was only a couple months after we'd been there. We got ambushed and ended up killing 16 or 19 guys. And I got a Bronze Star with Valor. I'd never heard of that award before. When I went into the military, it wasn't about that stuff for me. I was initially there just to get a better track in my life. In the middle of the firefight, one of our guys got hit and he fell right in the middle of where all the fire was happening. I just turned my brain off and went to the training that I'd done and really working off of instinct. Ran out there, turned my back to the fire, and was working on him while bullets were, I mean, right next to me. I was watching him bounce off the sand. After we got him back around a vehicle, we were facing the fire, and I was laying on top of him because I had taken his body armor and stuff off to work on him, and so he got hit in the abdomen and like tracked up his rib cage. Laid on top of him and was keeping him talking with me to keep assessing, how he was doing, and I had the wound dress as best I could for that situation until we got him back. I at that point hand, and it occurred to me the lights could have went out. Like I kind of woke up and realized the magnitude of the situation I was in. But they were happy with the way that I dealt with it, and so he put me in for this award, and it didn't mean anything to me really until after I got it, and then all of a sudden, everybody was making kind of a big deal about it, and it kind of got me back on this military, this hoo-ha thing, and I started toying with the idea. I was like, well, I do love doing the medical job, and I'm good at it, and so maybe it would be something to like try and go special forces and do, because I knew I hated the regular military. I knew that from like year one. But I always entertained the idea of, the special operations side of things is a whole different entity. So I got back to Germany. I was an E4 promotable, just waiting to get pin sergeant. And my platoon sergeant from Iraq had also come back on the same flight with me. He got put in charge of the IRT training, the individual readiness training for Europe. And so I was stationed in Vilsack. Vilsack was kind of the place where everybody who was getting ready to go out for OAF2 needed to come through and do this IRT training. So the IRT trainer, he pulled me on as a medical instructor for that course, and we were teaching a couple thousand people, gave them the medical portion of it. We'd go out to the ranges and requalify their weapons and everything, and basically just get them battle ready. It was really rewarding. I really enjoyed it, and I was training at that time to go to selection. That was what I thought I wanted to do. All that was going on. Everything was going great. And then the rest of my platoon got back, and there was this one asshole that I never got along well with. And there was this night that we were all out at the club in Germany, and he needed a ride home, and I let him ride in my car with me, and we pulled up to base. We had German gate guards at that time. And so he just starts like spouting off at these guys, calling them krauts, and like just trying to antagonize them. And so they did the only thing they could, which was mess with the driver of the vehicle. They pulled me over. They made me do a breathalyzer because of what he had done. I was like a point very low above what the tolerable rate was. I blew slightly over, and they sent me to the MP station, and we had just gotten a brand new battalion commander. I was his first DUI. The day that I went in for my Article 15, I had a half moon around his desk. All guys that I had served downrange with telling him, give this guy a break, don't strip him. He didn't take anybody's advice. He busted me down to E2, put me on 45 days extra duty, 45 days restriction. The same month that I started my extra duty and restriction, my points dropped. So all my other friends that were waiting to get promoted all became E5s, and here I was now in E2. I got taken off the IRT duty because my promotable status that allowed me to be an instructor there. So they took me off of that. They made me a line medic for an infantry unit. So when I had left Iraq, one of my medical platoon mates came over and took that position. Once they got back, he stayed their medic. So I went with the infantry, and I mean, I had a good experience with them, but at that point, like, I was just getting real sour about the military. That was a tough thing to stomach, and the biggest thing that got me were close friends of mine that I had been downrange with. They knew I would have taken a bullet for any one of them. All of a sudden, because I had something different on my collar, they started to treat me differently. And I was like, what? That's not brothers. You know what I mean? That's not what we're doing this shit for. And how am I going to go downrange and risk my life again for people that I know don't give a shit? Ended up, after I finished my extra duty and stuff, I got promoted to E3 again. And was doing the line medic thing with the infantry guys. A group of us took a trip up. We rented a car one weekend, and it was a long weekend, and we were like debating between driving to Italy or driving to Holland. And so Amsterdam won out, and we ended up going up there and spending a long weekend. And I ended up meeting my ex-wife. So that was the nail that sealed the coffin for me. I started dating with her from afar. I had about 3 months left on my original contract when we met, but they stop-lossed us. A stop-loss is if the military needs to, they will prevent anybody whose contract is coming up from leaving service. It's involuntarily, I guess you do sign on the dotted line, and that's written in your initial contract. They could easily argue that it's voluntarily because you signed it. But me personally, and the other 15 or so guys that I got out at the same time as, would all tell you that it was involuntary for us. When we finally got out, we caught wind that there was a lift on the stop loss for like a month, and our battalion didn't tell us about it. We went up to the battalion sergeant major's office, and we were like, if this is true, you need to give us the opportunity to get out. Fuck your numbers, you know? This is our right. We're human beings still. I remember he had us up in a conference room, and we were around like this round table talking with him, and he was trying to give us this spiel about how he didn't think that a lot of us were ready to go out into the real world yet, and this line of crap. You know, I stood up and I said as respectfully as I could at the time, I was like, Sergeant Major, I get what you're saying. If you look around this room and you can honestly say that if we end up having to deploy again next month and you didn't give us the chance to get out, and if one of us 15 doesn't make it back, you're going to get to go and tell our parents. Sorry, he didn't make it back. Oh, but he did have the chance to. I just didn't allow him to because they needed the numbers, and they needed, you know, every one of us that was getting out, I think, had been downrange. So they wanted people that were already battle tested. And so I got out and I ended up actually moving up to Holland to be with my ex-wife. We've been dating long distance for about 6 months at that point, and I had leave saved up already, so they paid me for about 3 months after I was out. And so I knew that I had some months kind of to kill before I was going to go back to the States and start school. I wanted to see what we had with each other, and she invited me in, and I accepted to move up there for about 6 months. Live there and kind of just tried to decompress and tried to get rid of the last years of what had happened, and was really excited about my relationship with her, was really hopeful about the future. I wanted to go back to school and become a PA and wanted to stay in the medical field at that time still. It ended up not happening that way, but that was the initial reasoning for going up there. And I had a fun time. I mean, I definitely did have some cool experiences. I was a bouncer in the middle of Amsterdam for like the last 4 months that I was living there at that time. And I was working out at a mixed martial arts gym over there. And that led me, once I moved back to New York, to get into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And I became an instructor while I was living there and was doing school and working at a hospital for the couple of years I was back in New York. And I left when I was 19 in 2000, and I didn't move back here until 2013. I lived in Texas, lived in Germany, then lived in Holland. When I started to live in Holland was after I'd been in New York for 2 years. And then my ex had come over, we got married in New York, and we had immigration complications. We didn't get a fiance visa before we tied the knot and didn't realize. And they ended up basically just refusing her anything. They looked at it like it was fraudulent entry into the U.S. And so they told us that the only way that we could really get it sorted out for sure would be for her to go back to Holland for about 3 or 4 months while it got sorted out. But there was also an agent that told us that if we went through the system, if we fought it and did all the right paperwork, that it could also be sorted out with her not having to leave. And we spent about a year trying to do that. My PTSD did not show until that first year, really, that I was married and had been out of the military for about a year and a half at that point. And that was when I started having anger issues and issues with dealing with my emotions properly. And I was still hypervigilant all the time. It's gotten better over the last 10 years or so, you know. The biggest positive I would say I've taken from it is the adaptability portion. I even remember my ex-wife, one of the things that she said was, "You're very adaptable." And that's something I think that I got from the military, from having to move around and having to kind of be, you know, ready to go whenever and have that whole kind of mentality, as well as the confidence that it gives you. I can't tell you how many times if something is going on in my day-to-day life, I remember I've been through tougher than this. This is not life or death. There's no reason for me to flip out about this right now. That I would say is the biggest lesson, just being adaptable and remembering that life is all about change. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. That being said, that's one of the big things with PTSD too, though, is I oftentimes have a real difficulty giving things importance because they're not life and death. And I have to fight to remind myself that it is important. Okay, it's not life or death, but it can't all be quantified like that. Sometimes you need to stress out about things that, yeah, aren't really worth stressing out about, but it's to get a bigger goal. And that's a tough balancing game to play. I was back in school. I was in New York. I was at a community college over there getting ready to try and go the medical route and do the PA program. Then I stopped that when I moved to Holland after a year of being married, and I opened up a construction business over there. Had never done construction in my life professionally, but it made my immigration really easy. Because I was opening up a business, they gave me my green card, no problems. And so I started to work with a family member of my ex who kind of took me under his wing and turned his back on me. And that was a shitty situation. But I found by that point I had made some other friends as well. And I had some guidance and some people looking out for me. And we took jobs together until I kind of knew what I was doing well enough that I wasn't going to fuck it up and cost myself a lot of money. I did that kind of thinking at that point that I would not go back to school. I mean, I thought I was going to stay over in Holland, and I really didn't explore options as far as the GI Bill overseas. I figured it was something I had in my back pocket for if I ever needed it in the future here. For the time being, I was going to try and do what I was doing. And I kept my business going for 5 years and, you know, made it through the recession. I'm proud of myself for that time, but I was divorced in 2011, stayed in Holland for as long as I could for my daughter's sake, because I did not want to leave her. I mean, that's the biggest thing I can feel like shit about myself for these days is the fact that that's where my life's at right now, is my kid is growing up without a dad over there. And I have contact with her every week, but I'm with a new girl now, and she's very much pissed off by that. She doesn't want to have any contact with me anymore. She gives me a half an hour. She wants to wait until my kid is 12 to let her visit the States, and she's 6 this year. That's the thing that I keep reminding myself about. That's what I give importance to my schooling. When my mind is telling me this isn't life or death, I remember my kid is growing up without a dad right now, because I was either going to stay over there and give her an example of a really unhappy father, or I was going to come back here and I was going to make something better for my life and at least be able to show her an example of happiness. So that's kind of my driving thing now. But when I came back in 2013, I moved back in with my parents temporarily and started at Tacoma Community College, thought that I wanted to do a degree in nutrition. More than anything, it was the commute that was killing me. And I was just like, I need to figure out something better. In the spring last year, which was my last quarter at TCC, I took an environmental science and an oceanography, two different classes, but in the same quarter, my eyes opened up and I was like, man, there is so much going on in our world right now that needs people to care enough to go and get these degrees and get these jobs that are going to make a difference. If I look at humanity, as far as looking at getting a healthcare job or another job where I'm trying to help people on a day-to-day basis, especially with nutrition, I feel like it would just be an uphill battle. I mean, it's not a wonderful paying job. It's very hard to get an established practice going. I kind of just got the attitude after taking the environmental science thing. I was like, you know what? I want to help the environment. Like, I want my legacy when I'm done with my work, with my career, I want to be able to look back and say that I did something that helped the greater good. I feel I can accomplish that through an environmental science or in some way working with the environmental issues that are going on these days. And so then I started to think about Evergreen as a possibility, because it was like, well, if I'm going environmental science, I mean, it's a great school for it. I started to look in more to the type of curriculum and the way the classes are structured. More and more, I liked the idea of it. I grew up with ADHD, and I didn't do real well in school for a large part because I just don't think it was the right format for me. My hopes with being at Evergreen is that kind of unconventional format would maybe cater better to my learning needs, and it is something that I'm really happy that I've made the transition to.